Well, good morning. Here we are in a brand new place, in the same place, almost. Our previous location is just a few kilometers back on the other side of the road. How many people have been to previous? About half. We, for a number of years, actually we started in 2015 and then missed two pandemic years at the Sea to Sky Retreat Center just back down the road. It's a smaller, more rustic location, but we love it. And so we miss it a little bit because it's a little wilder than here, and it has views out over the mountains. We're kind of tucked into the forest valley floor here along Brew Creek. But you saw the mountains as you drove here, didn't you? So you know they're just above us on both sides. And as we were driving here, I was reflecting on how different mountains are in different parts of the world. Here we're in a lush, coastal, temperate rainforest. But those of you who've been even just to the Rockies in Alberta and BC, they're very different. Much more rocky, drier. Different colors, the colors of the rocks, let alone desert mountains or polar mountains. So different, such different ecosystems and different relationships between the human cultures that live in those mountains or near them. Just a couple weeks ago, I was driving through the Adirondack Mountains of New York State. You see those red chairs out there? Adirondack chairs. That's where the name came from. Because the rich of New York and Boston would go to resorts in the Adirondacks and sit in those chairs by the lake. And the Allegheny Mountains of Pennsylvania. These are old, worn mountains. These are very old mountains. And they don't seem very high after living out here for decades. I was struck how dense they are with hardwood forests that have grown back after the logging and clearing for agriculture that the early colonialists did several hundred years ago, much longer ago than the clearing of the forests here. And even the lower Sauerland Mountains, so-called, of my childhood, where I grew up in central New Jersey, look now to me like what they are, rough piles of glacial rubble covered in thin soil. In the woods that I roamed as a child, though I was happy to hear, are still full of the birds that I learned as a child. Cardinals, blue jays, titmice, many kinds of warblers, cuckoos. I was woken by a very loud cuckoo when I was staying in a sort of tent cabin out there. How different. Even the west side to the east side of a mountain can be. When we first started this session, we just made it a long weekend. And we called it Mountains and Waters Session, named after the Mountains and Waters Sutra, or in Japanese, Sansui Kyo, one of the most beloved writings of Dogen, the Japanese monk who founded our tradition of Zen in the 13th century in Japan. And each year we've kept that theme of mountains and waters close, even though we've used different themes, different texts. And that first pandemic year, we looked at various hermits, ancient and modern, since we were all in our home hermitages doing this Sesshin online. But this year, we thought we would come back to our source, to Dogen's Mountains and Waters Sutra, now that we have a whole week to spend with it. When Dogen was a young man, he made the dangerous sea voyage to China, along with his teacher, to find what he felt would be, what he hoped would be the true, authentic Zen practice that he couldn't find in Japan. And he practiced in China for 3 years, and then returned to bring this particular way of practicing Zen back to Japan. And certainly he went on foot into the mountains where the monasteries typically were. And his writings are full of references to the changing seasons, the natural world, the mountains and waters, and the Dharma teachings that we can receive from the world, the wild world around us, as the body of Buddha. Mountains and waters have been associated with powerful archetypal qualities in many earth-based spiritual traditions, not just Buddhism. Mountains associated with height, transcendence, solidity, brightness, and water with fluidity, transformation, nourishment. We could see them as yang and yin, as the Chinese did, male and female qualities we all have within us, because we are all made of earth, water, fire, and air. And in Buddhist thought, mind is the fifth element. In Japanese folk Buddhism, mountains are associated with images. We should have brought ours from home. Images of Fudo Myo. Fudo means unmoving, and Myo means bright king. Bright, referring to his bright wisdom. And he's a very fierce-looking figure, more like some of the deities in Tibetan Buddhism. He has one blind eye, and fangs. One fang points up and one fang points down. And he carries a sword to cut through delusion and a rope, a little bit like Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom. But Fudo Myo is very fierce looking, and he's often seated in the middle of a ring of flames or on a craggy rock. His unmoving quality is not a kind of rigid immobility, but a dynamic stillness. Stable, poised, ready to respond, ready to speak or act in each moment, unhindered by the push and the pull of the eight worldly winds, pleasure and pain, loss and gain, fame and infamy, praise and blame, the eight worldly winds that typically we are just buffeted about by. And so we can't respond as skillfully and caringly as we would wish to. So this Fudo image is particularly revered by mountain ascetics in Japan. They're called Yamabushi, and they still exist. They're men of the mountains, maybe a few women, but it's very male. And they would go on long, long pilgrimages through the mountains and do ascetic practices such as standing under a cold waterfall, chanting the Heart Sutra as hard as you can so that you can stay under the waterfall. And this practice generates both ki or chi and a sense of camaraderie amongst your fellow practitioners who also survived standing under the waterfall. Michael can testify, having done it as a student on a field trip, and I cannot. Maybe someday. The women do this practice. The men wear just a scanty loincloth, and women wear a white kimono. A contrasting and complementary image often associated with water is Guanyin, or Kannon in Japanese, the Bodhisattva of compassion, who in Chinese and Japanese, probably Korean too, Buddhism, is depicted as female and often stands on a rock or in ocean waves, or sometimes rides in a, depicted riding in a small boat. So these complementary images of wisdom and compassion depict the two wings of our practice, right? Wisdom and compassion in balance. And if they're not in balance, we can't lift off and fly. These images are unfamiliar to us in our culture, but when Michael and I, and maybe some of you lived in Japan, and maybe some of you who visited there, you see them all over. And you come to see how deeply meaningful and beloved they have been in traditional Japanese culture, and to some extent still are. So I wonder and hope that we'll gradually create images of these kind of archetypal energies and beings out of this land, out of this culture, carved out of red cedar, you know, given form out of this land. Maybe you will feel Fudo and Kannon within you as you practice amongst the mountains and waters this week. So back to Dogen. He wrote this text, Mountains and Water Sutra, relatively early, before he established his large monastery, Eheji, which was in the remote mountains of west central Japan. He wrote this text before that. He wrote it in the year 1240, when he was 40 years old, for those of you who are in around that age, just imagine. And he was living at his first smaller monastery, just south of Kyoto. And he was just beginning to write these essays, these teachings that were gathered later into what's called the Shobo Genzo, the treasury of the true Dharma eye. And before that, before he started, not long before he wrote this, he spent several years living in a little hermitage on a mountainside southeast of Kyoto. The mountains that surround Kyoto on three sides are not that high compared to our mountains here. But they're lush, very dense with vegetation. And in Dogen's day, they would have been quite wild. Michael and I were last in Japan in 2016. Maybe some of you were on that trip. But before everybody else arrived on this tour, we decided we wanted to find the locations of Dogen's first little hermitage and his first monastery. And they are not on the tourist routes. They're not. You can barely find them on Japanese little guidebooks, small print. But we found them. And the site of the hermitage was on a hillside. And it's a different, I think it was maybe not a Zen temple anymore. No, sorry, that's the site of the monastery, the first monastery. And there's only one little sign to indicate that it ever was. But we walked up some stone stairs up higher to a little shrine, and we really had the sense of what it might have been like in Dogen's day. You know, the dense vegetation. And then we also had an even harder time finding the site of Dogen's little hermitage, which is now a very kind of nondescript working class area south of Kyoto, with a concrete kind of post-World War II concrete temple, not very attractive, and a kind of rundown garden, and just one stone inscribed with Dogen's poem that he wrote in his little hermitage that goes like this: drifting pitifully in the whirlwind of birth and death, as if wandering in a dream, in the midst of illusion I awaken to the true path. There is one matter I must not neglect, but I need not bother now, as I listen to the sound of the evening rain falling on the roof of my hermitage in the deep grass of Fukakusa. So he was quite young when he spent those years alone in the hermitage, and people gradually started to come and ask him about practice. So I just want to set this scene to help you imagine a time when the mountains and waters were a very close part of Dogen's life. All his life they were. Everywhere he went, he would have walked, beginning as a teenager, walking up Mount Hiei to practice when he became a monk. People in those days walked much more than the average person in our motorized vehicular culture does. So you will be walking more in this session than you would in an average Zen session. Walking is going to be part of your practice. You might think it's odd that he titled this text Mountains and Waters Sutra, since the word sutra usually refers to the oldest Buddhist texts, believed to be the closest to the Buddha's original teachings. Even though they were recorded several hundred years after the Buddha lived, they were passed on orally for generations. But Dogen isn't so arrogant as to say he's writing a sutra about mountains and waters. He's saying something much more radical. He's saying that the mountains and waters themselves are a sutra. The mountains and waters themselves are expressing the Dharma to us if we listen, if we see, without words. It's a sutra without words, even though he writes about it. So don't worry. I'm gonna read you his first lines, his opening lines. These mountains and waters of the present are the actualization of the word of the ancient Buddhas. Each abiding in its own Dharma state completely fulfills its virtues. Because they are the self, before the germination of any subtle sign, they are liberated in their actualization. So I don't expect you to actually understand that. Dogen's not easy. And in this session, we're not going to be doing a line-by-line study of the text. That's not what session is for. So when we will use some of Dogen's words, when we do, just take them in. Listen as though you listen to poetry or the songs of the birds in the forest. This week, our practice will not be to shut ourselves off from the world, but to let the world flow into and through us. To receive the teachings of the mountains and the waters, the trees, the birds, the creek, the insects, even the mosquitoes, and experience our own mountain and water nature. And we will do this mostly without words. Letting go of the habit of constantly narrating our lives, all those internal monologues and dialogues and the cacophony of our minds. We'll let the mountains and waters flow through and clean us out. So the mountains and waters in Dogen's text are both literal mountains and waters and much more. Mountains as ecosystems, mountains as universe, mountains as you and me. So let's listen to that first sentence again. These mountains and waters of the present are the expression of the old Buddhas. Each abiding in its own Dharma state fulfills exhaustive virtues. Shohaku Okumura, Michael's and my first Soto Zen teacher in Japan, wrote a commentary on this book. It's very helpful. Did not exist back when we started these sessions. And he says, if we understand this first sentence, we understand the whole of Dogen Shobo Genzo. Wow. Then he reverses the statement and he says, we have to study the whole Shobo Genzo to understand this sentence. So don't feel bad if you don't. We're not going to accomplish that in 1 week. But to give you a little help with this opening sentence, I'll attempt to paraphrase. Mountains and waters are all of this phenomenal existence, manifesting in dynamic interconnection, or as Thich Nhat Hanh says, interbeing, in each moment, right now, manifesting. Each being manifesting in its Dharma state. That Dharma state is a word Dogen uses and sometimes is translated as Dharma position. And it's, we could say the Dharma position is like the image of Indra's net, if you've heard of that. This vast, boundless net, and each intersection, each node, has a jewel that reflects every other jewel. And so this entire net is dynamically interconnected, and one little waver here will affect all the rest. So that's a Dharma position, but it's not fixed. It's always changing, always in relationship. So we are each, in each moment, in a shifting, changing Dharma position. That's what he means by Dharma state or Dharma position. It's hard to find the right words for these concepts. So Dogen is using mountains and waters like as an image like Indra's net, spanning boundless space and time, and saying that this is an expression of ancient Buddhas. Awakening, spanning boundless time. And we take our places in these boundless mountains and waters and fully manifest our lives. In doing that, we fully manifest the particular qualities that each of us has unlike anybody else. So I'm going to read that passage again. I'm going to tweak the words just a little. Each of you in the present is the actualization of the word of ancient Buddhas. Each abiding in your own Dharma state completely fulfills your virtues, because you are the self before the germination of any subtle sign. You are liberated in your actualization. See how it layers this one sentence. Dogen went on not long, very soon after he wrote this, to write another text called Uji, or Being Time, which we studied a few years ago, where he really elaborates this dynamic relationship between being and time. So this next sentence sounds difficult, but it's saying the same thing. Because they, mountains and waters, because mountains and waters are the circumstances prior to the kalpa of emptiness. That means before the Big Bang, before the beginning of existence of this universe, anyway. Because they are the circumstances prior to the kalpa of emptiness, they are this life of the present. Dogen is full of Zen paradoxes. Okay, just stay with it. Because they are the self before the germination of any subtle sign, that means like a seed before it germinates, right? They are liberated in their actual occurrence. Another paradox. Then comes this lovely line, since the virtues of the mountains are high and broad, the spiritual power to ride the clouds is always mastered from the mountains. And the marvelous ability to follow the wind is inevitably liberated from the mountains. To ride the clouds and follow the wind. Because the virtues of the mountain are high and broad, boundless. Of course, he's speaking metaphorically, but I can't help but feel that his expression is grounded in his actual experience of being out walking in the mountains. As any of you who have hiked above treeline probably can relate to, riding the clouds, following the wind. So that is Dogen's introduction. And then he gives us a quote from the Chinese Zen master Furong Daokai, who lived about 100 years before Dogen. The blue mountains are always walking. A stone woman gives birth to a child at night. That's the quote. And Dogen comments, mountains do not lack the qualities of mountains. Therefore, they always abide in ease and always walk. You should examine in detail this quality of mountains walking. Mountains walking is just like human walking. Accordingly, do not doubt mountains walking, even though it does not look the same as human walking. The Buddha ancestors' words point to walking. This is fundamental understanding. You should penetrate these words. So every time Dogen says that, you should penetrate these words, or you should investigate this thoroughly, he's giving us a koan. Words that say more than they appear to say. Words that you can only understand by going beyond our conventional dualistic ways of thinking. So let's take this as our koan for today. Blue mountains are always walking. How are blue mountains walking and are walking the same? You will have to do some walking to find out. Dogen continues, people outside the mountains do not realize or understand the mountains walking. Those without eyes to see mountains cannot realize, understand, see, or hear this as it is. If you doubt mountains walking, you do not know your own walking. It is not that you do not walk, but that you do not know or understand your own walking. Okay, so you're really going to have to do some walking and paying attention. Most people, and most of us, most of the time, walk about pretty mindlessly and do not understand our own walking. How many of you have tripped, not paying attention? Most of us do not have the necessity of walking as people in earlier times did. The poet Gary Snyder wrote in his 1990 classic, now classic, collection of essays, The Practice of the Wild. He pointed out, people of wilderness rarely seek out adventures. They don't need extreme sports. Life is a big enough adventure. Just meeting one's basic needs entails risk. Who needs to induce adventures when, as the Haida say, the world is as sharp as the edge of a knife? Feels that way anyway, doesn't it, sometimes? Like the world's as sharp as the edge of a knife. You're not quite sure how to move. Gary Snyder says, how does it look from the standpoint of peoples for whom there is no great dichotomy between their culture and nature? Those who live in societies whose economies draw on uncultivated systems. The pathless world of wild nature is a surpassing school, and those who have lived through her can be tough and funny teachers. Mm-hmm. Out here, one is in constant engagement with countless plants and animals. To be well educated is to have learned the songs, proverbs, stories, sayings, myths, and technologies that come with this experiencing of the non-human members of the local ecological community. Practice in the field, open country, is foremost. Walking is the great adventure, the first meditation, a practice of heartiness and soul primary to humankind. Walking is the exact balance of spirit and humility. I love that line. Few of us grew up walking this way. Though, in my case, from early childhood, I practiced walking silently in the woods. I had a little kid's book about a little indigenous boy named Little Beaver, which is, if we look back at it, would probably be pretty egregious at this time, but it taught me the virtue of walking silently in the forest. So I, not to betray my presence to a doe browsing with her fawn, I wasn't hunting them, but it was pretty great to see them, right? So I learned how to do that. I learned the names of birds and trees and flowers, but my life did not depend on this knowledge. At least my physical survival didn't. But thinking back, I think my spiritual survival did. The writer Rebecca Solnit, in her book called Wanderlust, A History of Walking, says, "Walking is a state of mind in which the mind, the body, and the world are aligned, as though they were three characters finally in conversation together. Three notes suddenly making a chord. Walking allows us to be in our bodies and in the world without being made busy by them." You know what busy walking looks like? You know, just go downtown somewhere. This is a different kind of walking. Mind, body, and world are aligned as though they're three characters finally in conversation. Isn't that great? So this is why walking meditation is such an important part of our practice. It's how we experience our body in relation to the world. Even right here in the Zendo, we have to be aware of the other bodies moving, to space ourselves, to be careful. Walking is how we measure our bodies against the world. We pace off a distance, right? That's why feet are called feet, right? I don't know why meters are called meters. Solnit writes, "Walking shares with making and working that crucial element of engagement of the body and the mind with the world, of knowing the world through the body and the body through the world." This is also why she says walking, making, and working share that body-mind practice, and that's why work practice is important in Zen. Cooking is important in Zen because we use our hands and our minds and our bodies. Chopping carrots, sweeping leaves, cooking rice. Just doing each thing fully, fully awake. And if we space out, something goes wrong. Sometimes. So we wake up. It wakes us up. Walking is what links us to our work and play and to each other. No other animal walks upright like we do, with our hands free to manipulate the material world in ever more sophisticated ways. We can reach for a weapon, or we can reach a hand out to help. John Napier was one of the first anthropologists to claim that upright walking began even earlier in human prehistory than previously believed. He says, human walking is a unique activity during which the body, step by step, teeters on the edge of catastrophe. Our bipedal mode of walking seems potentially catastrophic because only the rhythmic forward movement of first one leg and then the other keeps us from falling flat on our face. Right? Rebecca Solnit comments that this is easiest to see in small children as they're just learning to walk. These many aspects of the movement of walking will become seamless, but for a little child, they lean forward with their body, and then they have to kind of, their feet have to rush to catch up before they fall. You know? When you watch a little child learning how to walk, there's this leaning and then, boop, step, step. And their little bow legs always seem to be lagging behind a little or catching up. And often they tumble or fall on their bums before they master the art. Most of us don't remember how that feels. But it must feel somewhat similar for those who are learning to walk after a bad injury or a stroke. Has anybody ever had to learn how to walk again? Yeah, there's that. It's precarious, isn't it? Yeah. You might want to experiment a little with the sensations of walking when you're walking this week, that slowing it down enough to feel that balance shift, that leaning forward, that brink of catastrophe, and then the rear foot swinging forward to take your weight, keep you moving. Dogen says, you should study the Blue Mountains using numerous worlds as your standards. You should clearly examine the Blue Mountains walking and your own walking. You should also examine walking backward and backward walking, and investigate the fact that walking forward and backward has never stopped since the very moment before form arose, since the time of the king of the empty eon. That means forever, right? If walking stops, Buddha ancestors do not appear. If walking ends, the Buddha Dharma cannot reach the present. Walking forward does not obstruct walking backward. Walking backward does not obstruct walking forward. So you don't have to figure this out. You have to feel your way into it as you walk. Dogen's language makes our heads spin a little. But what he's talking about is walking as continuous practice. We move forward, we step back. We breathe in, we breathe out. Keeps going. In Fukan Zazengi, which we will chant later in the week, Dogen gives basic instructions for Zazen, and he asks us to cease from practice based on intellectual understanding, pursuing words and following after speech, and learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself. Body and mind of themselves will drop away, and your original face will be manifest. Your original face is you, not separate from everything else. Okay. You are the mountains and waters. The mountains and waters are you. Dogen says, walking forward does not obstruct walking backward. Walking backward does not obstruct walking forward. This is called the mountain's flow and the flowing mountains. So now mountains are taking on the qualities of water. They just flow more slowly than water. Although sometimes in a landslide, saturated mountainside can flow pretty quickly and bury villages, right? Mountains and waters together. Dogen says there is walking, there is flowing, and there is a moment when a mountain gives birth to a mountain child. So that brings us to the second half of the koan. The Blue Mountains are always walking. a stone woman gives birth to a child at night. What is he talking about? You have to wait till tomorrow. And Michael will comment. Spoiler alert, we will probably overlap in these talks. So if you doze off during one talk, you can pick it up the next day. We'll each talk about mountains, and then we'll each talk about waters, and then we'll each talk about our human relationship to mountains and waters. Okay? It's much harder to divide up Dogen than, you know, just koans. You can each take turn talking about a koan. This is harder, so stay tuned. So thank you, everyone, for listening, and let's chant together.
Page 3 of your chant.
May our intention